Session number 13577, reel number 1.
Weimark, reel 1. Can you tell me how you came to be in the RAF, please?
I volunteered for flying in the Royal Air Force when I was 25 in May 1940 and was accepted immediately for training as an observer. There was a two-year wait for the pilot training. After 3 months in England, in initial training wings, I was sent to South Africa for flying training at Oudtshoorn in the Little Karoo in South Africa. It was the first navigation course of the Empire Training Scheme in South Africa, and we flew in Ansons. On completion of the course in January 1941, returned to England by ship.
Before you go any further, could I ask you first why you wanted to join the RAF?
Well, I don't know. I'd always had a liking as a lad to fly, and I always wanted to cross the Atlantic. In fact, I never done that during the war, only after the war.
Whereabouts were you brought up?
In Brighton.
Before you joined the RAF, was there any bombing in Brighton?
Not in Brighton itself. There was after I joined up, but not before that. Yes, because up to May 1940 there was what was called the phony war for 6 months, and nothing happened at all, did it, if you remember? And it was only after they started really bombing in London that I thought, well, it's time I joined up. Because otherwise I would have had to wait for another couple of years and be conscripted in the army. I didn't want that.
How did they treat you in South Africa?
Oh, excellent. First class. They treated us... In fact, they... All the time they were sort of making sure that we came back to South Africa after the war, if we could. They really wanted to see us going. And of course, the South Africans during the war were one of the first class flyers, and in the army in particular, in the Middle East.
Where is this place, Oudtshoorn?
Oh, it's about, I should say, from Cape Town, it's halfway to Johannesburg. We went on the what is now the special railway tour that they do. we had a dusty ride in rather dusty old trucks, in fact. It took us, I think, 36 hours to get from Cape Town to Oudtshoorn.
So did you ever come across anybody in South Africa who took the German side in the war?
Oh, yes. Yes, we were warned while we were there to never go out on our own, always in pairs or threes, because of the Ottawa Brandwehr, it was called then. That was the German element. But I never experienced any trouble whatsoever.
Did any of your comrades experience any
trouble? No, we never experienced any trouble at all.
Did people treat you hospitably?
Oh, very well, yes. We were invited into houses for tea and lunch quite often. Oudtshoorn's a very English sort of place, of course. The people there were very good to us indeed. Of course, one thing we didn't realise that the young women, the young ladies of 14, they looked 18 to us. That's one of the things that we hadn't realised. So we were warned there to be careful what we'd done. As young men, quite obviously.
Was South Africa a good country to learn to fly in?
Oh, yes. It was good in as much as the weather was always perfect. But and, of course, the air was perfectly clear. You could see 100 miles from 8,000 feet, which wasn't really good for navigation because you could see where you're going and not supposed to.
Can you tell me on tape now what you were telling me earlier about how you came to be a navigator rather than a pilot?
Oh, yes. I became a navigator, I think, basically because it would have been too long to wait for pilot training. And when I went for my medical, my left eye was not as good enough, wasn't good enough for pilot training anyway. Also, of course, I had distinction in pure and applied maths and physics, which was the sort of basis for navigation anyway.
Now, you told me that in early 41 you returned to the UK.
Yes.
Did you return as a qualified navigator?
Yes, we were qualified there. Yes, we were promoted to sergeants in South Africa. And then we went on the short courses for gunnery and bombing in Pwllheli in North Wales. That was rather stupid, I think, in one way. We were flying in fairy battles where you sat in the back, two of you sat in the back, and you had to pull a sort of steel gadget on the floor, peer down underneath with your head underneath the aircraft to see where you were going, and you were covered in oil. But the only gunnery they could give us was the old Lewis guns with a round tins of bullets on the top, which is nothing like we had in practice, of course.
But was there any bombing that you were in when you got back and by the German Air Force?
Oh, yes, they were bombing London quite heavily then. But we never experienced any in Wales. Having completed those courses, I was sent off to the OTU. It was a 22 OTU in Moreton and the Marsh. Here again, it was the first course on the, and it was really Moreton in the Marsh. It was marshy, full of mud, brand new. Everything was brand new. There were only three Wellingtons available. And we then got together as crews. We met pilots, navigators, pilots, wireless operators and gunners. And we then flew as crews in daylight to get used to the aircraft, and so the pilot in particular could get used to the thing. Of course, Wellington was a lovely plane to fly. It flew itself, more or less. It's a pity they keep on about Lancasters, but it was the Wellingtons that really kept the war going in the first 3 years of the war.
Why did you like the Wellington so much?
Well, it was quite a nice aircraft to fly in. It was relatively silent. It had a certain amount of... the warming was from sort of tubes from the hot air of the engines, which you stuffed up your trouser leg if you could, if you felt... you were cold, but of course we had fairly good clothes anyway issued to us to keep warm. The cold didn't seem to worry us, I don't think. It was obvious at this stage of the war that both the RAF and the Luftwaffe decided that daylight bombing was impossible. They were losing too many aircraft, but on both sides, and it wiped out both air forces in a very short period of time. So night flying became the necessity in order if we wanted to take the war to Germany. And we as a crew were posted to 405 Royal Canadian Air Force Squadron at Pocklington.
How was your crew formed?
Oh, they put us together in a hall and you picked your own friends, and it worked perfectly.
Who was your crew?
Well, I had a Bill Allenson, what's the name? Oh, I had a couple of Canadians. I can't remember their names now. The wireless operator we picked, we never got very far with. Eventually, I got a Canadian wireless operator on 405 Squadron who flew with us. But the wireless operator wasn't that important, only a matter of giving instructions to land and take off. The idea of going to 405 was it was the first Canadian squadron, bomber squadron, to be formed. And we were told that as soon as there were enough Canadians coming over to fill our places, we would be posted on to other RAF squadrons. At that time, of course, there was no navigational aids like radar. Radar didn't come into operation until 1943. And we carried out our bombing raids in Germany in bright moonlight. The moonlight enabled you to see the rivers and lakes and coastlines in Germany quite well. And fortunately, my pilot, Bill Allenson, he was a very good map reader. He could visualize the maps, look at the maps on the, and then visualize what they would be like. And he knew where our course crossed a river at a certain place where there was a certain bend on it. And he could always pick that out and put me right, because it was absolutely necessary. You got a decent point of to pick out your position, your accurate position, so you could calculate the wind and the speed and the direction and keep ourselves on course. We gained experience for this by our own methods, in fact, and each bloke had a different way of doing it. And it was really confidence in your own calculations, known as dead reckoning in those days. On the 9th of September 1941, we were detailed to bomb the Spandau district of Berlin. 50 bombers took part. That was a maximum effort in those days. And Hitler had already guaranteed that no British aircraft would ever bomb Berlin. Anyway, we got there all right. The target at Spandau was fairly easy to identify because it's covered in various lakes and easy to take a point from which to take a line on and bomb the target. Anti-aircraft was quite heavy at this point. And I'm afraid of the 50 bombers, 7 failed to return home.
How frightening was it for you?
Oh, it was frightening afterwards. You didn't, at the time, it didn't matter. You could see the anti-aircraft shells bursting, but it didn't seem to matter as long as it didn't hit you. It was I suppose when we come back and landed, I suppose really was the way you thought back on it when you come back out of sleep at night.
Did you know what the target was in Spandau?
Spandau was a factory district. I don't know what the precise, I can't remember what this precise target was. I like to give a rear gunner something useful to do. He was in his turret all on his own at the back of the aircraft, and his turret was had 180 degree markings on it, and if I could get him to fix him his gun sight onto a stationary object like the head of a river or something, he could identify for about a minute, I suppose. He could then, that would turn his turret, that would give us the drift of the aircraft, as all aircraft drift according to the wind, sort of fly a bit cockeyed. And this was a very accurate way of giving me the drift of the aircraft. While we're over the target, the wireless operator, he was detailed to stand by the flare chute. There was a flare chute in all this aircraft, and a flare was already put in it, and all he had to do was to release it. And and as soon as I said, bomb's gone, it was his duty to let the flare go. This then went down with the bombs and opened up near where the bombs were dropping, and it gave the aircraft behind you a chance to see the target even better than we had. So in a way, this was the sort of start of the Pathfinder idea. The wireless operator then returned to his wireless set and sent a Q code to say that we'd successfully bombed. It was done in a Q code of three words, three letters. And I would also try and get the rear gunner to identify the explosion on the ground, because he could see them better than myself or the pilot could. And of course, I had to get back to my navigation seat and get the aircraft back home again. Here again, we got used to using the winds that we went out on to get back on, and it was usually pretty good. We usually got back to the coast of England, more or less on course. Over England, there were white light beacons flashed one Morse letter, and the positions of those were known to the navigators. They were changed every day, of course, so that the enemy couldn't get hold of them. And here again, I would ask the rear gunner to tell me when he was exactly at right angles, when it was exactly to get to the right angles of the aircraft. Then that would confirm to me that we were on the right course. And each airfield had red beacons flashing two-letter code, and it was placed about 2 miles from the runway that was in use. These chaps with the beacons had to move around, of course, with the wind. But this gave the pilot a good guide into the for landing into the airfields at night, which was quite hairy, really, because people weren't used to. And the runway lights were hooded, so you could only see them from the direction you had to land. It was rather slow for takeoff and landing. It was all done with Aldis lamps in those days, red and green Aldis lamps, red for stop and green for go. And it took about 4 minutes, or perhaps even a bit longer, to land using this method. And this was a long time to land 12 aircraft, the average squadron. Anyway, later in the war, we got more experience, and this was reduced to 1 minute, largely by the reduced use of VHF radio, which the pilot used to come into land. We would have direct conversation with the airfield itself. For takeoff, we still used red and green Aldis lamps because the Germans could listen into our VHF anyway, so it was not done. It was only done by red Aldis lamps. Navigation gradually became a science, and navigators got used to it. On a typical day, we'd parade at our various sections, discuss various methods of navigation we used the previous time, and then back to our crews, and there would be various orders, air tests, compass swinging, visits to the Met office. And the Met was very important, of course. In those days, the Met had quite a job on, because they could only get weather information from England and from the East. The only way they could get weather over Germany was from things like Spitfires, who would fly over Germany just purely to pick up what the weather was like, whether it was cloudy, because it was absolutely essential that the target was clear. Anyway, we would all meet eventually in the details would be up for, if you were on operations, for your various crews, time to meet in the operations room. And there, on the wall, would be a large map of Europe, and the route would be up on the wall, but not the last bit. The target was never put up until we were all sat in there and the doors were shut. And I remember the one for Berlin, and I think Hitler could have heard the roar when the navigation, when the intelligence officer put his target onto Berlin.
Was that a roar of pleasure?
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely. Oh, yes, yes, everyone wanted to have a go at Berlin, particularly as Hitler said, no one would ever get there. The navigation officer, the intelligence officer, would explain what the target was. He would try and pick out the flak areas that he knew about and possible night fighter areas. The Met officer would explain what the weather was to the best of his ability, and also to request us to bring back full observation of weather on the route, as this was the only way they could assess the weather for probably the next day. And as weather runs always from west to east, this was very useful to them. They knew that what they were getting today would be in Germany tomorrow, sort of thing. The average flight was about 5 or 7 hours in a Wellington, and we would be returned. When we returned, we were all interrogated by intelligence officers, and particularly about the target and about enemy opposition. After that, I'd done an abortive raid on Brest in France. The target was covered with clouds, so we brought our bombs back. Over Germany, we wouldn't normally bring our bombs back. We'd find a target of our own, unofficially.
Did you come back and land with the bombs?
Yes, we landed with the bombs, yes.
Was that dangerous?
No, not particularly, no. No, because the bombs were... The bombing arrangements were that the pin for the to make the bomb live was stuck on a piece of wire which was stuck to another set of points on the in the bombing bay which would hold the wire, and so that when the bombs released it would hold the pin in the bomb and make it live immediately it left the aircraft. That pin would then stay in the aircraft until we come back to land. On the other hand, if we had to drop our bombs for some reason or other, if we were damaged and couldn't land, we would leave the wires, we would release the wires so that the bomb dropped with a wire in it, and with luck, the bomb would not go off. And there were usually places to drop bombs, quarries and places like that where we could drop bombs. In fact, I never had to add that, never had to do that in any of my operations. Well, my Bill Allison was killed in a flying accident around the airfield, which made me a spare bod. And I filled in with other crews to where navigators went sick or for some reason couldn't fly. And I done a raid on Hamburg with a Sergeant Suggett. It was his second operational flight. I'd done four or five, I think I'd done six flights by then. So I was recognised as a veteran. I was in the bomb bay and let the bombs go. And we suddenly got caught in the searchlights over Hamburg. Anyway, Suggett knew what to do. He'd done a corkscrew out. And... I couldn't move because I was sort of prone in the bomb bay because of the G-force on against me. I just you're stuck to the floor. You just couldn't move in those circumstances. Anyway, the gyro compass toppled, and poor old Suggett didn't quite know what to do. Anyway, I realised. I said to him, "Well, look. All you got to do is fly straight and level for a couple of minutes and the gyro will put itself right." And sure enough, of course, it did. And when we flattened out, we were fortunately over the North Sea. We were about 2,000 feet. But poor old Suggett couldn't get any joy out of one engine. It was just going. It was turning over all right. And all the while he tried to accelerate it, it just wouldn't happen. Anyway, we eventually got back a bit late and couldn't climb, of course, because we hadn't got enough engine to climb with. And the next day we were told that a piece of shrapnel had just bent the copper tube, giving